Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. We're talking about memory. The book is 7 Steps to Managing Your Memory, What's Normal, What's Not, and What to Do About It. It's an excellent practical book that answers your pressing questions about memory. And the author, one of the co-authors, Dr. Andrew Butson, is with us. He teaches at Harvard. He's a professor of neurology at Boston University. He is an expert on problems related to the aging brain. We were talking in part one about strategies for keeping your brain healthy. We talked a little bit about diet. And I know there's some controversy about the most brain healthy diet, but basically don't eat junk, don't eat a lot of sugar, a lot of, artificial ingredients, trans fats. We know those are harmful. Keep your glycemic index low. What about exercise? Exercise certainly has been touted as a way to increase something called BDNF. Tell us about that.
Oh, absolutely. So I'm sure your listeners know about many of the effects of exercise. But the thing that has really been just a breakthrough in our understanding of how memory and exercise link together is through BDNF and other growth factors in the brain. So we know, I should start by saying when I went to medical school, and I don't know if this was true when you went to medical school, but when I went to medical school, I was told that the brain, yep, the adult brain, does not form new brain cells.
Exactly. We kind of joked in college about, after tying it on, with a bender, we would just wake up in the morning and just kind of joke with each other, how many brain cells did we kill irrevocably last night? And we said, since we have hundreds of millions, perhaps billions of brain cells, we got plenty in reserve, so we'll be all right. But actually, you can regrow brain cells. There's something called neuroplasticity, right?
Absolutely. So we now know that we all grow new brain cells throughout our adult life. And in fact, there's the highest concentration of the growth. Aerobic exercise in particular releases growth factors that help to increase the number of brain cells that our brain is producing. And this is something that is extremely powerful. It's basically a straight line relationship when it's been studied in animals, that the more they exercise, the more growth factors they release, and the more brain cells are produced. And there's even been studies looking at college students measuring the size of the hippocampus on MRI. And they found that after a 6-month exercise program, they can even measure the increase in the hippocampal size in these college students. So exercise is really important, and it's not only important by reducing the risk of strokes, but it is also important by producing growth factors that make new brain cells. It helps with mood. It helps with sleep, which is critical for memory. If you're tired, you can't pay attention. If you can't pay attention, then it's going to be hard to remember. So exercise.
But there's even this notion of what's called the glymphatic system, which is sort of the brain's cleanup system. Which, if you don't sleep adequately, your brain may retain certain waste products that may be deleterious.
Absolutely. And in fact, beta amyloid, which is inside those amyloid plaques, that is what we believe starts the whole Alzheimer's process, those are cleared by that glymphatic system while we're sleeping. And so sleep is critically important for that reason as well. And as I was mentioning before, it's also the time that our memories are transferred from a short-term temporary store to a long-term permanent store. So sleep is important for all those different reasons.
In other words, memory consolidation.
Exactly.
Which they say, we had the wrong strategy back in med school. I don't know about you, but I was prone to pulling all-nighters because I felt guilty, wasting even a couple of hours sleeping. But it was exactly the wrong strategy because the best way to remember and retain information is to cram and then get a good night's sleep. And that way you kind of embed the memories in your brain, you'd be able to regurgitate them better.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. In fact, what the studies are now showing that it's better, study material, say, you know, every night during a full, say, college semester, one is much more likely to consolidate all of the information and have that information perhaps stick around for a lifetime than if one crams, say, the week before the test. Even if you got a good night's sleep each night, we're just simply not able to consolidate, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm, for example, a whole semester's worth of information, you know, in a week of sleeping.
Exactly.
And, yeah. And in fact, you know, talking about strategies, there were so many things that I did in medical school that I have subsequently learned were not the best ways to study. So I was one of those guys that had, you know, one of those click button pens with the four colors, and I had my different mm-hmm, color highlighters, you know, and I'd be highlighting my books and underlining things, right, and I would reread it before I study for a test. And I felt like I really learned the material well. And sometimes I would do well on the test and sometimes I wouldn't. Well, it turns out that that is not a very effective way to study. But because I'm rereading the same material, it gives me the illusion that I learned the material well because it's familiar to me and it's easier for me to reread it. But that doesn't actually mean that it got into my brain. And it turns out that if I had done something just slightly differently, if I had taken notes that summarizes the material in my own words, mm-hmm, and I put those notes on index cards and I quizzed myself with them, which is, of course, another very common way of studying, I would have learned the information so much better. Mm-hmm. That has been shown in studies to be about five times more effective, even given the exact same amount of time studying, than is the highlighting and rereading.
Yeah, good stuff. That I wish we'd known about that research in those days. This brings us to another topic, which is these brain teasers, brain games. This is a multi-million dollar, if not multi-billion dollar industry, where you've got oldsters, you know, clicking away in their iPads, trying to do puzzles and various types of challenging memory tasks. You know, and the idea is it's like brain calisthenics, right? I mean, if you do enough calisthenics, you'll develop your muscles. If you do enough mental calisthenics, it would seem to be that you might develop your mental faculties. True or false?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, I think the muscle analogy is a good one, because to do a computerized brain training game, it might be sort of like, you know, you're lifting, you know, you're doing your left bicep and you're really training that left bicep and it's getting really big and really strong. But just like, you know, if you're doing curls that are going to strengthen your left bicep, that's not going to do anything with any of the rest of the muscles in your body. Mm-hmm. And doing computerized brain training games is the same way. You will absolutely get better at those games.
Right,
and just
right.
If you do crossword puzzles or Sudoku, you get better at crossword puzzles and Sudoku.
And it's seductive because you can see the metric. You see, I mean, you know, when I just started, I wasn't doing well. And then like your scores get better and better and you think I'm getting smarter.
Yeah, but you're not really getting smarter. You're really just getting better at the game.
Yeah.
Yeah. But there are things that can be helpful. So what the studies have shown is that probably if you want to be doing something with your brain, do something new. Learn something new, whether it's taking up a pottery class or a yoga class or learning a new language, mm-hmm, or learning about a new place that you're going to visit. Learning things new, that has been shown to be helpful, along with social interactions. You know, so I have some of my families of my patients with the very best of intentions, you know, like they don't want their husband, you know, who has mild dementia to be wasting his time, you know, sort of fooling around with his friends on the golf course. Mm-hmm. But as it turns out, you know, and the spouse would much rather have him like sit in the care in the chair and do his brain training activities.
Right.
But in fact, doing golf where you're going to be walking on the golf course and engaging in a social activity, that's actually much better for you. In fact, I think there's evidence that, you know, if you do like crossword puzzles or Sudoku or brain training games, you know, again, a very small part of your brain is going to be working very hard. But our brains were actually made for socialization. And so when one is in a social setting, that's when the whole brain is going to be lighting up and working.
Mm-hmm. Sensible advice. Okay, so when people start to have memory problems, it can be very, very depressing, and it can cause a great deal of anxiety. And it becomes kind of a chicken and egg thing, you know, which came first, the memory problem or the anxiety or depression? Because we know that these mental states rob you of memory. So how do you know what's more contributory to your problem?
Yeah, that can be a very tricky thing. You know, there used to be sort of a rule of thumb that, you know, if people have, you know, anxiety and depression along with some memory loss, you might as well assume it's the anxiety and depression and work on treating that. But the fact of the matter is, in today's society, there are few things that are as anxiety provoking and depressing than being worried that one is having Alzheimer's disease or being aware that one is having memory loss. And so, I would recommend that people work with their doctor, try and figure out which of these is the first thing, and treat whichever one feels what started the problem. I would say in my own practice, if one comes to see a memory specialist, it's not that difficult to sort it out. Mm-hmm. But I think it can be difficult for the individual or their family to tell.
Mm-hmm. And, there's a lot of buzz about Alzheimer's research. And what we're seeing is that, some drugs are being developed, but they only seem to have marginal transient effects on memory. And these major efforts by the pharmaceutical companies to, I mean, this is a potential bonanza for them if they came up with an effective drug. Again and again, they've failed. Why is that? Are they looking at the wrong paradigm? Are they trying to dissolve amyloid plaque when the problem may reside elsewhere? What's the hangup?
Yeah, this is a very good question, and your question is really on target. Let me just start by saying that the standard FDA-approved medications, these are medications like Aricept, the generic name is donepezil, you know, they work by turning back the clock on memory problems by 6 to 12 months. And they can't stop the clock from ticking down, but people will always have better memory when they're on the drug than when they're not. So I just want
to affect they jazz up the neurotransmitters a little bit, but they don't repair the brain or stop the process that's leading to inevitable memory deterioration.
Yeah, exactly right. And so there are new medications that are being developed, as you said, in clinical trials that are working to either stop the formation of the beta amyloid that goes into those plaques or to actually remove the plaques from the brain. So the current theory as to why those treatments have not yet been successful is that we haven't started early enough. So we believe the disease starts with the plaques, and the strongest evidence is that people that have a genetic disorder where they make too much beta amyloid end up getting Alzheimer's disease. So we do think it starts with the amyloid. But once the tangles start to form inside the cells, it seems like the tangles spread throughout the brain via the brain's connection. And once that starts, you could remove all the amyloid from the brain and people are still going to develop dementia because the tangles are spreading throughout the brain. And it's sort of like the horse is out of the barn if you're intervening at that point. So we believe that it's really important for us to start these treatments early. And there are several large national studies that are funded by a partnership between NIH and the industry in order to get people into studies even before they really have any clinically apparent memory loss. So even before people have any diagnosis.
And that argues for early detection, but of course, sometimes the signs are subtle. Is it true that personality changes precede Alzheimer's? I saw an article about that recently with a surprising conclusion.
Well, it's interesting. I'm not sure if I saw that article. I would say that the most common personality change that can occur with Alzheimer's is apathy, that people are not quite as sort of proactive as they used to be. I will just mention that if there are many personality changes that occur as the first sign of any sorts of problems, particularly if people are disinhibited and mm-hmm. they're saying inappropriate things, it actually makes me worry about other types of dementia.
Which is a rarer type of like frontal, some kind of frontal apathy or frontal brain apathy, which is a subtype of this, right?
Right. Frontal lobe dementia or frontotemporal dementia are other causes, other than Alzheimer's.
Frontotemporal dementia. Yeah, one wonders if, we'd like to get a hold of the brain of the Las Vegas shooter to see if he may have been, that's one theory. Was he prone to some sort of brain disorder that disinhibited him and allowed him to commit unprecedented violence? Because the part of the brain that is involved in conscience and judgment was damaged.
Absolutely. So chronic traumatic encephalopathy, which we now know is much more common than we had previously thought, can impact many different parts of the brain, including those that regulate behavior. So I speculate along with others, would the same outcome have happened if he didn't have chronic traumatic encephalopathy pathology in his brain?
A question that I get a lot from patients is, given that the brain is composed largely of cholesterol, we have a national campaign to lower people's cholesterol with statin drugs. Is there any evidence from the research, now we've had statin drugs out for, several decades, that lowering people's cholesterol dramatically to sometimes double digits has any adverse effects on the brain? While it protects the heart, that it may in some way increase the risk for brain deterioration?
Well, as you say, the myelin of the brain, which makes up a large bulk of it, is made up of lipids. And so I would worry to some extent about reducing the level to such a very low level. And I also think one thing that has been noted is that people tend to be more irritable when mm-hmm. their cholesterol is lowered to that level. And I think that is probably related to its brain effects.
And when we come to, when we talk about early forecasting, maybe for some of these clinical trials, is it legitimate to look at genetic tests? Because one of the genetic tests that's been touted as a predictor of Alzheimer's is this APOE test, where if you have a double hit on APOE4, you have a much increased likelihood of degenerative brain disease. Is this in the future? Do you see that as having some utility as maybe helping us select people who might be candidates for some of these preventive strategies?
Yes. So I think that, in an individual patient that I'm seeing in the office today in 2017, there isn't a good reason to get the APOE allele and figure out whether somebody has the standard one, which is 3, or the one that has an increased risk of Alzheimer's, which is 4.
And it's pretty frightening to get that result. And, just knowing that might create more harm than good since we don't have definitive strategies for dealing with this.
Exactly. And that's just what I was going to say, that once we do have a definitive strategy, then I believe the whole world, at least my world with the memory disorders, is going to change, because then it would really make sense to get screened. And if you have the allele
like cholesterol screening, you know, preventively.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I can see that, just like people get, you know, their screening colonoscopy at age 50, I can see that age 50, one might be getting this genetic test, or even a special type of a PET scan that can look for amyloid plaques in the brain. Mm-hmm. And if these things are positive, be like, okay, Mr. Jones, we are going to start you on treatment to make sure that you never develop Alzheimer's.
So, bottom line, in working with patients who have the beginnings of memory loss, you know, perhaps not due to classic, you know, Alzheimer's disease that's well on its way to causing a lot of amyloid plaque, can people retrieve their memory? Are there techniques to help manage this problem, and can they function better by using some of the techniques that you mentioned in the book?
Absolutely. There are so many different strategies and memory aids that that people can do to help. Some of the things that we recommend, we have three golden rules. In one part of the book, we talk about don't delay, so that, you know, if you're somebody that you've gone to the trouble of setting an alarm on your phone to remind you to take a medication, if the alarm goes off, you know, just because you're having a, say, a deep conversation with a friend, don't put off taking that medication until you finish the conversation, because you'll be likely to forget it. So,
or if you make a date on a phone call, you know, just write it down. Don't rely on your memory, because it might not be as robust as it once was when you were younger.
Exactly. Exactly. The next golden rule is keep it simple. So if somebody is working with a calendar, that's great. But to have three or four calendars, that can be very confusing, and you're copying information and it can be dropped or lost. So keep it simple. And then our last golden rule is make it routine. So if you're somebody who is misplacing their keys or their glasses or their wallet or their purse, if you always put those things in exactly the same place when you come into the house, then they're always there when you need them. You're never hunting around for them.
And finally, you know, in this day and age of passwords and computers that have amazing memory capabilities, and with the complexity of modern society and all our tasks that we're subjecting ourselves to, do we have unrealistic expectations for our memory? Sometimes I think that it's not so much that people have declining memories, it's just that they have they burden themselves with an undue expectation that they can keep it all in their heads.
Absolutely. I think that's very important. And that's why the first step in our book, we talk about understanding, you know, what is normal memory and what are the limits of normal memory. And you're right. I think sometimes people think they're supposed to remember everything that ever happened to them for their entire life. And that's just not the case. And so
if it were to happen, we would rapidly run out of processing space in our brains. Actually, forgetting is an important evolutionary adaptation of the brain, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, my mentor, Dan Schachter, has done a lot of work on exactly that point, and how our memories really appear to be designed not so much for remembering things per se, but our memories really evolved in order that we can flexibly and creatively imagine new types of scenarios in the future to be able to deal with those scenarios better.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, on that final note, what's today's Intelligent Medicine take-home message? Where are some resources that people can learn more, in addition to obtaining your book, 7 Steps to Managing Your Memory?
Yeah. So I'm a big supporter of the Alzheimer's Association. They can provide lots of of information for individuals that are worried about their memory, or families that may be concerned about their loved ones.
And the research are particularly important for the families because they are the support system that is really the guarantor of safety and well-being of the sufferer, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. When we talk about treating individuals with Alzheimer's disease, we really talk about treating the whole family, the whole support system. That's right.
Mm-hmm. And is there a website for the book or for you and the research that you're doing?
Yes, yes. So www.andrewbudsonmd.com is the website. And you can also find me under the same name on Facebook and on Twitter.
Okay. And it's Budson. And what kind of resources will people find there?
So there are many different types of information. I try to post scientific articles that I think are well done and are relevant on these different types of conditions, as well as resources that people can learn more about, for example, how do you know when it's safe to drive and when should somebody hang up the keys and things like that.
Self-tests or questionnaires?
We have links to those as well.
Good. All right. Well, thank you so much for boiling it down in very practical terms for people who, and this is a huge concern. I'm in primary care and I can vouch for the fact that this is a major concern for such a high percentage of patients, and you've addressed it beautifully in your book, Seven Steps to Managing Your Memory. Thank you very much, Dr. Andrew Budson, for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.